Lecture 20, The Fabulous 18th Dynasty Rolls On.
Hello again. Last time we talked about Thutmose III, the greatest military leader Egypt ever had. What I'd like to do today is talk about still the 18th Dynasty, and it just keeps rolling on and it gets better. There are three pharaohs we're going to talk about today. Two are really good, and one's incredible. They're all related, all descendants of Thutmose III, our man. Now, the 18th Dynasty, in some respects, is the high point of Egyptian civilization. It's where it gets superpower status, where it's right on top of the world, and we're going to see it reach its peak today. Now, first, the successor of Thutmose III, Amenhotep II. Right? A military man like that, really strong. He fights in Nubia. Everybody always went down to Nubia, beat up the Nubians, bring back the gold. He did that. And when he came back on his ship, he tacked up seven Nubian princes on the prow of the ship. So when they sailed into Thebes, there were these seven guys upside down and dead for a long time. Then, when the ship finally docks, he takes six of them and he hangs them from the wall of Karnak Temple. So this is a guy to be reckoned with. His tomb is interesting, by the way, for an archaeological reason. He's buried in the Valley of the Kings, and every tomb in the Valley of the Kings is numbered. We have a number for each tomb. It was set up by an early Egyptologist, Gardner Wilkinson. When I say early, beginning of the 19th century, what he did was he went through the Valley of the Kings with a bucket of paint and a paintbrush, and he said, here's the tomb, two, three, and he numbered the tombs. Now, and since then, whenever we discover a new tomb in the Valley of the Kings, it's numbered. Amenhotep II, he has KV-35. That's King's Valley, or Valley of the Kings. King's Valley 35. What's interesting about the tomb is not so much the decoration, not so much the painting, the architecture, but when they discovered his tomb in the late 19th century, they found bodies of other kings in there. We'll talk about that later, but it was an interesting cache of royal mummies. Anyway, when he dies, he is succeeded by Thutmose IV. Now, Thutmose IV may have had a weak claim to the throne. I'll tell you why. There's a little bit of suggestion that he had a shaky claim. And the reason is between the paws of the Sphinx. Now, remember, the Sphinx was carved during the Old Kingdom, right, going back 1,000 years, during the Old Kingdom by the Pharaoh Khafre. It has the head of Khafre, the pharaoh, and the body of a lion, symbolizing power. But between the paws of the Sphinx is what we call recumbent, it's lying down, between the paws of the Sphinx is a stela, our old familiar round-top stone that's carved. And the stela tells the story of Thutmose IV becoming king. And let me tell you the story, and you'll see why I suggest that he may not have had the strongest claim to the throne. Now, the inscription on this stela says that when Thutmose was a prince, he wasn't king yet, he was hunting in the area of the Sphinx. And at noon, he decided to take a nap in the shade of the Sphinx. Right? Convenient. Now, remember, the Sphinx is like 1,000 years old by this time. It's like an archaeological wonder almost. And the Sphinx, by that time, had been pretty much covered up in sand. Up to the Sphinx neck, pretty much. And, you know, in this century, it was even covered up almost to its neck. And periodically, the Sphinx has to be cleared out. So, in the time of Thutmose IV, the Sphinx was covered in sand. And he's taking a nap in the shade. And he has a dream. And the Sphinx, in the dream, speaks to him. And it says, O prince, if you remove the sand that encumbers me, I will make you king of Egypt. Now, with the Sphinx saying, I will make you king of Egypt, it suggests to me that he wasn't next in line, that there was probably older brothers, perhaps, or some other reason. But anyway, Thutmose, when he wakes up, continues his hunt, I assume, but later hires workmen to remove the sand from the Sphinx. Right, so he does an archaeological clearing of the Sphinx. And he became king. Now, to commemorate his becoming king and this dream of the Sphinx, he had this stela carved and placed between the paws of the Sphinx. So that suggests there was something special about his becoming king. It wasn't sort of standard procedure. Let me tell you an interesting thing about this stela also. It's a lovely thing to see. It has a Sphinx carved on either side. It's a nice inscription. But Sir Alan Gardner, I talked about him in the beginning when I said there are different approaches to history. He was the philologist. He's the one who looks at language and tries to figure things out. Sir Alan Gardner is one of the great translators, and he translated this stela. And one of the things he points out is, when you read the stela carefully, listening to the language, it's not really the language of the 18th dynasty. This stela was not really carved by Thutmose IV. It's older. I'm sorry, it's newer. Thutmose IV is older. It's much more recent, carved by later priests, probably, he says. Now, why would later priests carve this stela? There's two possibilities. One is, sure, Thutmose IV carved the stela, put it between the Sphinx. It got damaged, and now the later priests are replacing it. That's certainly possible. That happened quite often, and it's almost probable. But why would the priests bother replacing this? Well, the answer is, these are priests of the temple next to the Sphinx, and they want to show how powerful the Sphinx is, because he's our man. So to make sure everybody knows how powerful, they sort of refurbish this stela and say, look what the Sphinx can do. It made this guy king. But anyway, it's a story about how Thutmose IV becomes king. Now, he does the usual for the 18th dynasty pharaohs, military campaigns. He's good. But he also has a curious thing. There's an obelisk that he erects, and it's the strangest obelisk in Egyptian history, as far as I know. His grandfather had this obelisk quarried, and apparently it was lying on its side in Karnak Temple, that major temple that we'll talk about later in some detail, lying on its side in Karnak Temple in Thebes for about 35 years. Nobody ever erected it. And Thutmose IV took it upon himself to erect the obelisk. So he erects an obelisk that his grandfather quarried. And the reason I say it's the strangest obelisk, and first, we don't know of any other obelisk that lay on their sides for 35 years. The other is, it seems to be a singleton. Obelisks always come in pairs because they're on the outside of a temple and you walked between them when you entered the temple and you could see all the glories of the pharaoh carved on them. This seems to be one of. It's a singleton. Didn't come in a pair. Curious. And if you want to see that obelisk, you have to go to Rome. It's in Rome, and it's the largest obelisk standing today. It's 105 feet tall. But that's where you can see the obelisk erected by Thutmose IV in Rome. Remember, Rome has more obelisks than any other city in the world, 13. But Thutmose IV, good, strong king, military, right in the tradition of his family. So we've got two good kings that we've talked about so far. We're going to get a great one now. Let me tell you one other thing to look at, though, in this dynasty. And I mentioned it once before. If you want to see stability, if you want to see when Egypt is doing really well, look at the length of the reigns of the kings. See how long the kings rule for. We're getting kings ruling for more than 30 years each time. You know, you get Thutmose with a nice long reign, Thutmose III. You get Amenhotep II with a 30-year plus. You get Thutmose IV with a good one. The next one's going to have more than 30. We've got four kings in a row with long reigns. This is stability. It's kind of like almost often it used to be when a president is reelected. You know, he gets the hang of it the second time. He's controlling government better. You've got a king who's been in power for 35 years. He can really do stuff usually. He's got the right people in place. So these first two kings are nice long reigns. It's going to continue. Now for the real glory years. Amenhotep III. Now, Amenhotep III, again, remember, names are important. Amun is pleased. The god Amun is becoming the most important god in Egypt. No question about it. What makes a god the most important? It's the pharaoh. It's where he puts the money. The pharaoh is the one who supports the temples, basically donating whatever they get in military campaigns to a temple. So Amenhotep III, his name really says it all. Amun is the big god. Now, at this time in history of Egypt, there are really two capitals of Egypt. There's Thebes in the south, which is the modern city of Luxor, which has become the religious capital. This is where all the great temples are built. And this is where the pharaoh comes for religious ceremonies. And this is where the god Amun lives, in Thebes. But there's still Memphis in the north. That's the administrative capital. That's where the bureaucracy takes place. And there was plenty of bureaucracy. Because remember, taxes had to be collected. You had tax collectors going out throughout Egypt. You had a very large middle class in Egypt. People who kept the government moving. It is not unlike Washington, D.C. Not unlike. Huge buildings, lots of small offices, lots of people doing paperwork, checking records, checking on each other. Same thing. Big bureaucracy, but lots of money coming in. Right? So we've got two capitals. Thebes as a religious center, and 500 miles to the north, we've got Memphis as the administrative center. Now, where does the king hang his hat? Pretty much in both places. He will live mostly in he'll live mostly in the north, in Memphis. But he's going to go to Thebes for religious processions, for all kinds of ceremonies. He's going to have a palace there. So he goes back and forth. Now, Amenhotep III, what do we know about him? Plenty. And I'll tell you how we know it. It's a unique thing that he starts. Amenhotep III sends out the first telegrams in history. Now, what do I mean by a telegram? They're called commemorative scarabs. These are beetle-shaped carvings. They are carved out of stone in the shape of a beetle, which was a good luck symbol, you'll remember. And on the bottom of it, on the bottom of the carved beetle, are hieroglyphs. Right? The beetle's about maybe 3.5-4 inches wide, something like that. And on the bottom is a hieroglyphic inscription. That's the telegram part. That's what Amenhotep is using as his telegram. And he had these, whenever anything big happened, or an event he wanted to tell the world about, he would have his sculptors carve maybe 100, maybe 200 of these scarabs, these beetles, with the message, this is what I've done. And they would be sent out throughout the world. They would go to Syria. They would go to all corners of Egypt. They would go to Palestine, probably send them into Nubia. And they made announcements. This is a key source of what happened in the life of Amenhotep III. The first one he sends out is in about the second year of his reign. And he says, I'm getting married. Right? It's his wedding announcement. Carved on the bottom of these scarabs. And this is how we know the details of the marriage. And you have to read between the lines to know what he's saying. He says, I am taking as a wife Queen Tai. Right? So her name is Queen Tai. She's going to be Queen Tai. She's going to be the great wife. Her parents are Yuya and Tuya. Now, between the lines, Queen Tai is a commoner. That's why he mentions the queen's parents. And what he's basically saying, and this is a guy who is really self-assured, he's saying, the queen is a commoner, but you better accept her. Now, I don't mean to suggest that Tai is this barefoot waif, you know, in his torn dress. Not at all. She comes from a prominent family. She comes from a prominent family. Her father, you know, Yuya was a key military man. She had a brother, Anan, who was a vizier of Lower Egypt, which is like a prime minister. No, this is not a poor commoner, but she doesn't have that royal blood flowing through her veins. But Amenhotep III can do whatever he wants. The 18th dynasty is really powerful. What other of these commemorative scarabs does he send out? What's a big deal to him? Well, he's apparently a hunter. He talks about the wild bull hunt, right? And he says he captured 56 wild bulls in a day. I'm sure he had help, but, you know, he's doing something. And I think there's also a lion hunt scarab, where he says he captured something like 102 in 10 years. Right? So he's hunting lions. And then there's one that becomes important later, but I want you to remember something about it. He talks about Queen Tai and what he's done for her. He's done something really quite interesting. He's built for her a pleasure lake. It's about a mile long, right? Near their palace in Thebes, in the south. Right? And he says it's large enough that she can sail her boat on this lake. And he even gives the name of the boat. Now, this is the Egyptological trivia that I want you to remember, because it's going to become important in the next lecture. What's the name of the boat, right? It's sort of like the math problem, you know, when a boat goes upstream at 4 miles an hour, but the stream is going 6 miles an hour. What's the name of the boat? What's the name of the boat? The Aten gleams. The Aten gleams. Now, what's the Aten, and why is it shining around? The Aten is a minor god in Egypt. It's the solar disk. Right? It's a solar disk, and the name of a boat is the Aten gleams. Okay? It's nice. Remember it, please. It'll be very important. One more commemorative scarab. He marries a foreign princess. But this isn't considered bad for Queen Tai. She's on the scarab as the great wife. Right? She's the queen still. But he mentions that, you know, around year 10, he marries a foreign princess. No big deal. He's got plenty of wives. Plenty. And a lot of these foreign marriages, again, as I said before, are diplomatic marriages, just to kind of cement relations. Now, during the time of Amenhotep III, Thebes is at its greatest. It is powerful. And the wealth is coming from a new source also. It's not just going out and smashing the Syrians, the Nubians, the same old stuff. No. Amenhotep III is a diplomat. He works out trade agreements with foreign lands. This is new. You don't have to just steal it, right? He goes out, and there are all kinds of trade agreements. So wealth is coming in through trade. Not only that, Egypt has its own gold mines. Like, not a big deal, but in the Wadi Hammamat, the place where they used to find all that good stone for the sarcophagi and things like that, they found gold mines, so they're mining their own gold, which was hard, by the way. Gold mining was really hard in ancient Egypt. But you've got gold from the Wadi Hammamat, you've got gold from Nubia, you've got trade agreements. Egypt is doing just fine. You know, one of the ways you can always tell if Egypt is doing fine is by the tombs of the wealthy. Look at those tombs and see, are they really posh? Are they really good? If they are, you know Egypt is doing quite well. One of the tombs, the mayor of Thebes, Ramoza was his name, has a tomb. And if you look at the walls, beautifully carved, elegant. I mean, these artists are really good by now. And it's a big tomb with columns. It's carved into the mountain, but it's got big columns. Egypt is doing just fine. I mean, the tomb of Ramoza is an indication, really, of what's going on. And what's going on is wealth. Now, Amenhotep III is a builder. And what tourists today know as Luxor, Thebes, the skyline of that city today is to a great extent due to Amenhotep III. He's the one who really starts building up Luxor and making it great, right? So Thebes is becoming this beautiful city. This is the city, by the way, that Homer called Hundred Gated Thebes, because it had so many temples with so many doors. That's Homer's Hundred Gated Thebes. He builds what we call today Luxor Temple. He builds a temple dedicated to the god Amun, right? His name is Amenhotep. Has traditional scenes on it. We even know the name of the architect. We even know the architect, right? It's Amenhotep, son of Hapu. There were so many people named Amenhotep, that you distinguish him eventually by son of Hapu, son of so-and-so. We did that also, you know, like, for example, a name like Mendelssohn. It's Mendel's son, right? Johnson was John's son. And this is Amenhotep, son of Hapu. He's the architect who was later deified, became a god. But Amenhotep is building, and he's building well. He also builds a palace, which is rather unusual. I mean, this guy's kind of unusual. It's called the Malkata Palace. It's an Arabic word. It's where you find stuff, actually. But it's mud brick. Now, this guy, who has so much wealth, could do anything he wants, builds his palace out of mud brick. Why? All the pharaohs did it. Why? You wanted to build your temples and your tombs for eternity. They had to last. But a palace, if it lasted a generation or two, that's enough. So the palace is built out of mud brick. As a result, it's unfortunately terribly damaged. We only have short walls. You know, the walls that we have are maybe 2 feet high, 3 feet high at best. But you can get a glimpse of how it was done, how it was decorated. It's beautiful. You know, you think of mud brick and you think of a hovel. But the mud brick was plastered over with white gesso, white plaster. And then on the plaster, they did frescoes. So you've got beautiful scenes of the gods, of plants, of animals. It must have been dazzling, really dazzling. And it's next to this palace, fairly close to this palace, that Amenhotep III built the pleasure lake for Queen Tai. Now, understand that we're dealing with 18th dynasty queens now. We've already had one queen, Hatshepsut, who ruled Egypt and then changed to king and ruled it as king. Queen Tai is a powerful woman. She is a significant part of this family. Significant. There's a wonderful statue of her. It's a carved wooden statue of her. It's about the size of my fist, a little bigger. And when you look at it, you say, this is a woman you got to listen to. It's a portrait. It's a wonderful portrait. You just see this strong-willed woman. Queen Tai was a factor to be reckoned with. Now, the palace was large. It sprawls, because you had to have plenty of rooms for kids, concubines, wives, and there'd be a section for the cook and the kitchen. I mean, it went all over the place. And it's kind of interesting to walk it. You get a feeling for, this must have been the nursery where the kids were. This must have been this. You know, he could have had 30, 40 kids. Right? And it's quite something. No tourists go there. It's a kind of thing that there's better things to see, I guess. But it's wonderful to get the feeling of an ancient palace, and it's where history happens. It's really quite something. Now, he becomes a bit of a god in his own day. The pharaoh, of course, was always a god. He was the falcon on earth. But he also takes another name, the dazzling sun disk of all lands. Right? The dazzling sun disk of all lands. It's an interesting title. Remember, Queen Tai's boat was the Aten Gleams. What we're getting, is a slight, gentle, perhaps, shift in religion. It seems as if this Aten, or sun disk, is becoming important. There seems to be a bit of a change. Another interesting thing happens with Amenhotep. Many interesting things happen. He moves permanently to Thebes. In his later years, he moves to Thebes permanently to live in that Molkata palace, the palace of mud brick, but was rather quite nice. We don't know why. Normally, the pharaoh would have lived at Memphis, the administrative center where you can keep your finger on things, and you'd vacation or you'd go for religious ceremonies to the south. You know, it may be that he was getting old and wanted to head south. You know, people head to Florida. He may have wanted to go to Thebes. May have been his old bones were tired. It could be. But it could also be that religious things are becoming more important to him. It could be that the dazzling sun disk of all lands, as he's called, wants to be in the religious capital of Egypt. So he moves his permanent residence. Now, he also builds his mortuary temple. Now remember, the mortuary temple is where he is going to be worshipped forever. It's not where he's buried. He will be buried in the Valley of the Kings. But his mortuary temple is where he will be worshipped. Now, the mortuary temple has unfortunately virtually disappeared. It's on the west bank of the Nile, of course, on the west side of Thebes. It was huge. I can tell you it was huge because you can see the outlines of it. The water table has risen in Thebes. And now, the place where the mortuary temple was is quite moist. And it's right next to the cultivated field. Sugarcane grows around the mortuary temple of Amenhotep III. So the temple has literally sunk underground. It's underground. I mean, someday, I think it's going to be excavated. You know, you bring in water pumps, you do this. When it becomes important enough, people will do it. And you'll find the mortuary temple of Amenhotep III. But what fronted the temple is still standing there. It was so big, it didn't sink in the ground. And that's what's called the Colossi of Memnon. These are two huge statues, you know, like 60 feet high. I mean, huge things. And they are of Amenhotep III. They're called the Colossi of Memnon. Why? When the Greeks visited Egypt, they saw these statues. And they said, ah, Memnon, one of their guys. And the name stuck. So the Colossi of Memnon, which is what everybody talks, you know, everybody calls them that. You go to Thebes on vacation, they'll say, oh, you want to see the Colossi of Memnon? Were really two colossal statues of Amenhotep III that you passed between when you entered his mortuary temple to pay respects. So the priests every day would go between these huge statues. They're wonderful to look at up close, by the way. The Greeks who came there all carved graffiti on the legs of the statues. So there's wonderful inscriptions. There's long poems. There's I came and I wondered. I came here and I listened. There's just sort of Kilroy was here stuff on the Colossi of Memnon. Now, one of the Colossi became famous in the ancient world because it's called the vocal Memnon. It spoke. Now, what do we mean it spoke? That's what some Greek travelers said. It spoke in the morning. Now, we're almost certain what it was. There are cracks in the statue. It's terribly damaged now. Both statues are terribly damaged. But this vocal Memnon, in the morning, when the sun rose and hit the statue, it would warm up the rocks of the statue. And it would expand a little, and wind would whistle through it, and you'd hear a sound. That was the vocal Memnon. Now, unfortunately, it doesn't speak anymore. The statue was restored, and it doesn't say anything anymore. But these are two of the monuments that we have left of Amenhotep III. Now, Amenhotep III, when he died, is buried in an unusual place. He's buried in the Valley of the Kings, but not the same section. He decided to be buried in a spur of the valley, off to the side. We call it the West Valley. No one had ever been buried there. It's like a separate entrance to the Valley of the Kings. Right? Even the numbers are West Valley, so-and-so, West Valley, so-and-so. First pharaoh ever to be buried in the West Valley. Don't know why. Why he chose not to be buried with his ancestors. They're great ancestors. Everybody would want to be associated with people like that. Maybe it was a religious reason. You know, maybe there is a religious shift away from the traditional or something like that. But he's buried in the West Valley. Now, he and his great wife, Queen Tai, have six kids. They have four daughters and two boys. The eldest boy is going to be the king of Egypt, right? His name is Thutmosis. And he has an important title. You know, he's a high priest of Memphis. Even the girls, the four girls, are given important titles. One is, you know, one is called the king's wife, right? Not really the wife, but given an important title like that. But young Thutmosis, the prince, dies before he becomes king, which leaves his other brother, his brother, to become king. Right? Now, an interesting thing about this brother who's going to become king, who wasn't supposed to become king. The four daughters are given titles. Prince Thutmosis is given a title. He's high priest of Memphis. Big deal. But this other brother is never mentioned in the records. Until the end of the pharaoh's reign, Amenhotep III, as he's old, as he's infirm, takes this unmentioned son, who's hardly mentioned, and makes him co-regent. Remember, started by the Middle Kingdom pharaohs, this notion that if you wanted to make sure who your successor was going to be, you take him as co-regent, you rule together. Well, he takes this kid, who's not mentioned in the records, wasn't supposed to be king, and makes him co-regent. Now, you wonder why. He was powerful. Was there uncertainty about the reign? Probably not. Sometimes you could take a co-regent when you couldn't rule by yourself. Maybe you're getting too old. Maybe you're not fit. And I'll give you one suggestion of why he takes a co-regent. I've looked at the mummy of Amenhotep III. And his teeth are so bad that he must have been in almost constant pain. Perhaps even he had to be sedated with wine. Or they even had opium in the 18th dynasty. Could have even used opium. So it may be that he simply couldn't function and had to take this kid as co-regent. But I'll tell you, this young prince who wasn't supposed to be king turned Egypt upside down. We'll talk about him next time. See you then.